It was 2005, and Monday, and the afternoon. I'd taken the bus into town. I was in Delaney's Cafe on the corner of Rosemary Street and Lombard Street in Belfast. It's a cafe near O'Now. It wasn't a nice cafe. The coffee was okay. What they called pizza was an eggless quiche. The base crumbled against your fork or your spoon. It had booths and something of the American diner to it. It was dark, and the green lampshades kept for themselves more of the light than they shared. A double bass somewhere wished it could walk out. A saxophone flirted with elsewhere. I was reading Camus or something. At adjacent tables, people smoked cigarettes. I took another refill from a waitress who wore a uniform the green of the lampshades. I had overstayed my welcome. "Who do you think you are? Tom Waits or something?" she said. I said no. It's Valentine's Day.
Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. I'm Rachel Brown. You just heard Stephen Sexton's memories of a very special St. Valentine's Day. In this amatory episode, Ian Sansom talks love songs with Glenn Patterson, Shakespeare's sonnets with Leontia Flynn, and Black Masses with Tim Lone. The inaugural book finder's chair, Caitlin Newby, reads some love poems, and Kieran Carson sings a song for a blue-eyed lassie.
What's the best way to...
I like the knock on the door idea. We could.
Okay. How about we fake it here?
Hello.
Are you there, Glenn?
Yes.
All right. Good. It's Glenn Patterson, the director of the Seamus Heaney Centre. So
You took me by surprise there.
Come into the parlour.
Come on into the parlour.
And what is? How long have you been here? Not here.
I've been at the Seamus Heaney Centre since it opened its doors.
When was that?
Well, the door is actually the front door. We only opened about 3 weeks ago, but there has been a door that if you had a keypad number code, you could get in for 15 years.
15 years?
So for 15 years, I've been forgetting my keypad.
All right. Code. So it was about time to open the door then?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so yeah. We opened the door. 15 years.
15 years.
So, autumn 2003... We opened. And
who was here then? It was you.
Well, the first director was Kieran Carson. And I had been here already. I'd been the writer in residence in the mid-1990s. And we set up a creative writing undergraduate course that then became the MA in creative writing. And before they opened the Seamus Heaney Centre, we just used to hang out in Book Finders Cafe and Bookshop, just across the road.
Out the window.
See where I'm nodding there?
Yeah, just behind me there. Yeah.
And so we used to go there, Maeve McGuckin, Dara Carvel, and I used to go in there. And then they opened the Seamus Heaney Centre across the street, and we thought, well, that looks okay, and we won't have to pay for our coffee.
So it was proved.
Well, no, actually, we were wrong about that. All we are paying for the coffee still.
Yeah.
15 years, I've nearly worked off my bill. So that was creative writing. All the people who were teaching creative writing were given offices in the Seamus Heaney Centre. And the great thing was that at that time, the door numbers, you will have noticed this, won't you? They all had numbers. I think the first office I was in was 2003.
I'm in 2006.
You're in 2006. Well, 2003 then, of course, was the present. And in room 2006 then was Sinead Morrissey.
Right.
I think was the writer in residence at the time. And she seemed to me like the future, being 3 years ahead of me. And of course, year by year, I kept trying to catch up. And I moved into 2006, in 2005, but now it's all history. I think that probably anything I know about love, or most of what I think about, I think a lot of it came from 7-inch singles.
Right.
You know, I think I grew up on...
What are we talking, the Buzzcocks?
No, I think pre-Buzzcocks, I grew up when the Stylistics were the house band and Top of the Pops. So okay. a lot of Motown and Atlantic Records,
yes.
Stax.
What's the Sam Cooke? There's a Sam Cooke song.
Cupid.
Cupid, shoot your...
Right, okay, so every time I go into a karaoke bar, with some trepidation, I go over to the songs available, and I, with my fingers crossed, I look to see if they've got Cupid, and if it's not there, I breathe a sigh of relief, because it was there. My bet with myself is I must sing it.
Really? So what's it? What's
Cupid? Draw back your bow and let your arrow go straight to my lover's heart for me. Cupid, if your arrow makes her love strong for me, I promise I will love her till eternity. I know between the two of us her heart we can steal. Help me if you will.
Well, that's... I can't think of a fight. That's...
Unless it's given me just a little more time by the chairman of the board.
Okay.
Which is... I realise that a lot of the love songs, too, that I respond to seem to have mountains in them. So River Deep, Mountain High.
Right.
Than which there are a few songs better. Unless it is, indeed, chairman of the board, give me just a little more time, which has a line, love is that mountain we must climb. Let's climb it together, your hand in mine. Which is... Given the sedentary lifestyle I lead, it's not just the love that I feel there, but it's, I feel like I've just been exercised.
These poems that I'm going to read are inspired or based off of hymns to the ancient Sumerian Mesopotamian goddess Inanna, who was the goddess of love and beauty and sex and fertility and war, among other things. So these, I guess, are kind of pagan Valentine's Day type things. I should also say that the titles come from Rihanna songs, so there's a little pop culture splashed in there. Love the Way You Lie, Part 2. Lady of all the divine powers, bright, competent woman, bright, popular mistress of heaven, dressed in large jewelry, with fine hair fit for a priestess, who has gathered up all the divine powers, who has seized all the divine powers. You have taken up the divine powers, you have clasped the divine powers to your breast. My lady, beastly, flint-toothed lady, because of you the threshold of tears is open. You roar with roaring storms. You regularly thunder. You fatigue the storm winds. Who can cool this raging heart? On foreign lands, frown, the great gates they are burning. Rivers flow for you and the people must drink. They have their troops captive for you. They scatter their elite regiments. For you, strong men stand at your service. Tempests fill the dance halls of their city. On their husbands, women no longer speak with affection. In the dark night, you take other laws. You show him your naked, virtuous heart.
What, so, can I ask then, if let's say you had to teach, let's imagine it was Leontia's
love
college for bards, and you had to do a course on love. Like, what would you include in the what would be in the curriculum on the reading list?
Well, I would put The Wife of Bath on from Chaucer, kind of, just because I keep meaning to reread it. I'm assuming I'd like that bit of Rhyme Royal, you know, and it's rude. There's quite a lot of swearing in it, isn't there?
Yeah.
What's not to like?
Yeah. Saucy.
Saucy. Absolutely. And some of those old stuff, all those old things people think, you know, they're so much more radical than some stuff now. It's just like, I can't believe they said this. I also can't believe nobody noticed. I don't think people think people read things wrong, you know? They're like, I don't know, it's like people, I always, so many books, like Shakespeare, I mean, I would put the sonnets on.
Yes.
Because I thought, boring sonnets. And then read them, was like, holy crap, this is like Netflix. It's like, who's doing what to who? I don't even know. It's amazing. Oh, man.
Go on.
Okay, this is the second one. Without me. Without me, you have been exactly that. I have launched you nowhere. I have launched myself no further than this desk and west-facing window, where were I to keep a calm and vigilant reach, I would hold the weeks and months from filling a breach that makes unbridgeable your rooms at Rushfield. The days when you took the clockwork out of things, striking a new sound from a dud motor. When we meet now, we cannot but be slightly older, outside under a ticking, bewildered sky.
I tell you what I've always loved about
always wanted to ask you.
Okay, go on and ask me what you've always wanted to ask.
Is that you on the back of the...
Yes, that's me on the back. I'm on the front.
Come close to
me. Oh, sorry. Yes. I didn't want there to be an author photograph. I spent a long time trying to just get that photograph on the cover without an author photograph. What? That's why the author photograph, I look like I'm having a stroke, because I don't like getting my photo taken. But so I just give them that one. I'm 2.5 and I look like I'm smoking a fag, which I thought was really funny, but it's actually, I felt tip-top because my mum didn't let me smoke as a baby. So there you go. That would have been wrong.
What age were you allowed to smoke?
Shh, I don't really, I don't, never, five, that never six. Happened. That was, no, let's just say no. No, that's what it looked like. I'm about to go travelling. I'm carrying a small bag and I just thought it was really cool. I'm kind of fat. I liked it.
That's brilliant.
I know.
What's it in that book? Yeah. That first one, I can't remember.
Yeah, it's the first one, yeah. Uh-huh.
Were there love poems in that one?
There are love poems in all of them. I write about love, I've got to be honest. Yeah. I don't feel good about it. And yeah, you know. So I do actually do write about love.
Quite a lot,
right? Yeah, actually, I do, yeah. Actually. Well, I just could do what I know.
Yeah.
I did, and I was, so they're not happy, so, you know, it's a short subject. It's not like I go, yay!
You don't want a long love poem, though, do you?
Well, that depends what kind. I mean, I like desolate love poems. I like poems which are unflinchingly honest about love. I think they're the best kind, and I think that they make me feel less lonely. So I don't like the hearts and flowers stuff. It's just stupid, plus it's boring. And, I like the complicated ones, and there's all different kinds of love, right? So I figure it's one of the big subjects, okay?
What's
with
the
death
yeah.
and food, not food, something else.
You don't do a lot of food ones.
No, I don't.
No.
I don't.
In terms of the most unflinchingness, uh-huh. unflinching
love poems.
What are we talking?
I guess, I suppose, I just because, you know, a lot of my preferences are kind of accidents. I just kind of, I'm like a sort of, one of those really, you know, a little robot-y thing. You kind of, it sort of goes off around a maze and just goes, oh, I'll just go this way because it hit a wall. I think it's just because I taught Robert Lowell that I went, oh, look, this is amazing. These are so, oh, I mean, I suppose it's life studies, then the man and wife and so on. It's, I mean, that is just kind of in your face, true, I guess. I don't know, it blew my mind a little bit. But they're dark. They're really dark. Yeah, love is awful. Love is terrible. Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, no, thanks.
Okay, I'm a screenwriter and a playwright. I used to be an actor and director as well, but I ended up... How did I end up here? I don't... I was glad that the job was available in the first place. I had a fascination with how people write. I wanted to think more for a while about why or how I would do work as a screenwriter particularly. So working here in Queens was a chance for me to sort of step back from the idea of writing for a while to look at it objectively. I think that's why.
Did it work?
I think so. I think I'm a much better writer now than I was eight, 9 years ago. That
we'll
I
be the judge of that.
Well, I think, yeah, okay. I think I am. I'm certainly more confident in it, I think. I tell you what, it's not that I'm a better writer. I'm better at fixing problems.
Right.
I'm better at seeing what's wrong with my own writing. So, yeah, I think I've learned to become much more objective about it. And that, I suppose, comes, no accident, that it comes from looking at other people's, looking at students' writing and taking an objective stance, you know, trying to work out how to develop or a writer's work.
So Versailles was the last big thing, was it? Or, yeah. Or did I miss one after that?
Well, Versailles, which was on BBC 9 months ago, right. Was the last thing that I had produced, yeah.
The hell did you end up doing that? That was massive, wasn't it?
It was huge. They sold it to over 140 different countries, I believe. I didn't know there were that many countries in the world. There couldn't be too many more than that. But so there's 15 that haven't got it.
Right.
But that it was a hugely popular worldwide hit. There's no question of that.
And what was the secret? What was the secret of the success of that then, do you think?
I think gratuitous nudity, attractive people. And a kind of there's people have a fascination
with Louis XIV. I didn't really have much interest or knowledge. Certainly, I had no knowledge of him before I started to work on it.
Did you not? Nothing at all?
No, I just knew that just there was a big fancy castle somewhere near France, near Paris, near France. But and I must be very clear that I started working on the second series and then I storylined the third, but I had nothing to do with the first at all. So
That was the best, obviously.
Well, I can't question that. I ask you to run your quality control over the three and then you can come to your own conclusions. Yeah. But no, I only mean that by way of I can't take any credit for the creation of the idea or the setting of it
And did you have to, were you living in France to do it?
Oh, goodness, that was the best part of the job. It was one of the best parts. I had an apartment in the centre of Paris. Because I had to be there a lot, there was a lot of script discussions. There was a lot of great. Oh my goodness, we developed the treatments for that series over more than a year. But that particular position, I was writer of the storylines of those over the whole series, and I wrote three scripts. But as well as that, it was a nice position because it involved a kind of a. We were treated as showrunners. We didn't get the title showrunners, but it meant that we were consulted for casting and for directors and design. And, you know, so it was, we had, you know, was sent rough edits. So we're giving edit notes and things like that.
So showrunner is what exactly?
Showrunner is someone where the buck stops, really. So the buck stops with someone like, I'm trying to think of David Chase for The Sopranos. For instance, he certainly wrote all the overall story arcs. He didn't write all the scripts, but he wrote many of the first ones. But he would have been, the showrunner would, choose, would certainly have a final say over the choosing of cast and directors and designers on the shape and the feel of the overall show. It's all the power and all of the responsibility. This was my first proper taste of that for the third series of Versailles. I loved that because, well, working as a screenwriter, working as any writer, as you well know, is a solitary existence. Mm. So it's nice to get out every now and then. It's nice, even nicer to get out and be hanging around with studios with a whole cast of very talented actors and directors and the whole scheme. Yeah. So
in France,
especially in Paris, it was really lovely. Yeah. It was lovely. Yeah,
could be worse.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And what about so? Because this is our. You may not know this, but this is our special St. Valentine's edition.
What have you got me?
Well, and I'm just wondering. So with Versailles, it's all about love and betrayal, isn't it? Essentially,
yeah.
When you're writing when you were doing it, is that
in your mind? Absolutely, it's all about love and betrayal, but it's also about faith and God and about destiny and believing what you've been told you are. It's about finding your own identity and all of that without question. But there's no doubt that one of the main interests in Louis is his remarkable love life. And the fact that we know so much of the you know, has been written in the history books about what he got up to and who he got up to it with and how often, which is extraordinary. This man had staying
really?
Power.
This man had staying George power. Georges Simenon levels of...
Oh, my word, right through until, I think he died in his 70s, I think. And he was still very busy. He was... He kept going right through, but it was his love life was central to the drama that we were working on, which is why originally myself and Andrew Bamfield, the two of us who worked on it together, we were pitching a fourth series, which was going to involve there was a famine and there was a mutiny in the army and all fabulous big juicy things that happened in Paris or in France at the time, but actually the simple truth came down to the fact that his private life became kind of dull. You know, by the end of series three, he has married the woman who he was going to marry, who's going to stay with for the rest of his life. He became an uber Catholic. He did everything, or rather, he made everything look like it should have been. You know, he did everything properly above board. Of course, he was still very active in the bedroom department with plenty of other people, but he didn't change his situation from then on. So we would have had to make stuff up.
Right.
And that was where we kind of, well, and we were happy to make stuff up. But
see, this is one of
that might have been messing with the crown jewels, I think, to somebody to a step too far.
But isn't that one of the big differences between what you know, love in life, that you value love in life, if it's kind of if it continues on, it is uncomplicated, whereas in drama the very thing that you want is complication and
absolutely
kind of crisis and confront, all of those things, isn't it? So
it is, isn't it? Yeah. So yes, I suppose it's like if one is writing EastEnders, and a story is running out of juice, then you throw in an affair, you mess with people's hearts. Yeah, definitely.
And I've often wondered, doesn't that make the kind of what we do, it's basically a lie, isn't it? Do you know what insofar as, you know, we you know, the idea that literature or kind of drama holds up a mirror to nature. We're not doing that at all, are we, actually? Are we holding up a mirror to nature? What you're doing is you're kind of showing a different... You are necessarily having to, as you say, to juice it up.
Well, you're juicing, yeah, you're heightening it, you're juicing it up, but I don't think it's unreal. I mean, I think it happened. I know plenty of people who've been through all kinds of relationship difficulties over the years.
Yes.
And I think, so I suppose that's the other thing, the truth stranger than fiction question. I mean, many of the things, for instance, to go back to Versailles for a moment, many of the things that Louis got up to, people, you know, that he was, one of his closest mistresses was his brother's wife, his gay brother's wife. That's absolutely true, you know. The things that he got up to were true.
Yeah.
The things that people did for love back then were true. They had black masses. They sacrificed babies. They really did that stuff. So,
I missed that episode.
Oh, in series two, yeah. Oh, yeah. There was when I started working on it, they said, okay, so it was episode six in series two. So, Tim, are you happy to do the orgy episode? And I go, yeah, okay, yeah. Which also was the beginning. Well, no, and then episode nine was the baby sacrifice episode. Baby was saved. It's okay. Don't worry.
Right. Baby okay. Well, saved. I'm reassured.
But there was a black mass, and the baby was about to be sacrificed for love. This was a woman's Madame de Montespan's pursuit of Louis. She wanted to cast this spell. That's true, or rather, there is evidence to suggest that that is true.
Okay.
So are we holding up mirror to nature? Yeah, I think we are.
Stay. Shocking how I feel to see my one with such a shock of hair, like a tousled tamarisk and so distinguished. O pleasure, O man with the eyes of my brother, like a god gently worked on, beer mottled and mirror shiny, come at night and stay with the sun, come, O bright countenance, and exert yourself.
I'm going to try a song called The Bonnie Blue-Eyed Lassie. How can I live at the top of a mountain with no money in my pocket, nor gold for to count it? I would let the money go, all for to please her fancy, for I will marry no one but my bonny blue-eyed lassie. She's my bonny blue-eyed lassie, with an air so sweet and tender, her walk just like the swan that floats, her waist so neat and slender, her golden hair in ringlets rare falls down her snow-white shoulder. And I'd ask her for to marry me, and no man could be bolder. Some people say that she's very low in station, and more people say she'll be the cause of my ruination. Let them all say what they will, my love for her will prove constant still, till the day that I die. She's my own lovely lady. Lightly swims the swan o'er the dark waters of Ochil, and sweetly sings the nightingale. So happy to behold her. The wind it blows, the moorcock crows, the moon it shines so deeply. But deeper by far is my love for my own lady. A tad high, strumming for the top notes there, but it'll do.
The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast was produced by Stephen Sexton, Ian Sansom, Rachel Brown and Connor McCafferty. With thanks to our guests Glenn Patterson, Caitlin Newby, Leontia Flynn, Tim Lone and Kieran Carson. And to Nicholas Boyle for the music.